Commerce will now come to order at 3:30. We're running a few minutes late because of a previous meeting in this room. With us are Representative Chenault, Vice Chair Newman, Representative Lynn, and Representative Book. The only item on the agenda today is House Bill 68, price gouging. And to deliver the bill is Representative Peterson and his staff. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pete Peterson. I'm the state representative for East Anchorage Muldoon area, District 19. And the reason I decided to file this legislation is because I had a large number of constituents asking me how come our prices were so high, and of course the Judiciary Committee had an investigation ongoing at the time, and we thought maybe they might come back with some information. As it turned out, I don't believe they've gotten to the bottom of the problem yet. But high fuel prices have had a devastating effect on Alaskans, Alaskan businesses, and Alaskan communities. This bill would establish an act of charging excessive or exorbitant fuel prices as an unfair trade practice, and it would provide strict penalties in order to deter potential violators. This bill establishes an objective threshold where the burden of proof shifts from the seller to show the price that would need to be justified. Now, the biggest misconception about this bill is that it sets prices. It does not. The 10% threshold is simply a triggering mechanism. And prices would still be legal above that 10% as long as the people producing fuel could prove that the prices were not the result of exorbitant profits. Currently, the Attorney General, when he does an investigation, he has to find that there is collusion or price fixing in order to solve a problem of exorbitantly high prices. This would give him an additional tool in his arsenal. Now, historically, Alaskan gas prices have been close to those on the West Coast, but last year we saw Alaskan prices become dramatically higher than the prices anywhere in the country. And this disparity remains to this day. Last year, the legislature suspended our state gasoline tax, yet still Alaskan gas prices are higher than any other state in the union. And we have got a page that we put together that's got a listing of what the prices of gasoline are in the states when you take everyone's state gasoline tax off. And as we all know, Alaska is one of the world's major oil producers, yet states with no industry, oil industry at all, are enjoying lower prices than Alaskans. Now, high fuel prices have hurt Alaska's economy. The price of almost every good or service is in some way tied to fuel, since things have to be shipped here and shipped from one part of Alaska to another part of Alaska. And that's one of the reasons Anchorage experienced a 4.6% inflation rate last year. High fuel prices are especially hard on Alaskan small businesses, since rising fuel costs increase their expenses while decreasing their customers' demand. I've heard from small businesses owners across the state who are concerned that high fuel prices will force them to scale down or to close. Separate investigations by the Attorney General and the House Judiciary Committee and the Legislative Research Division have all shown that high prices are the result of abnormally high margin charged by Alaska's two major oil refineries. The graph on the chart of the Legislative Research Report clearly shows that even as the price of crude oil fell, the margins charged by the refiners increased disproportionately to margins charged by lower 48 refiners. Currently, this bill would only apply to refineries, but after hearing from the people all across the state of Alaska, I ask on behalf of myself and the other sponsors of this bill that the committee adopt a friendly amendment to include wholesalers, distributors, and retailers to this bill as well. Especially, I've been hearing complaints from people who live in the rural parts of the state where they have only one person who sells or supplies fuel to that area. High fuel prices are continuing to hurt Alaskans and Alaskan businesses. And prices traditionally rise in the summer, so we could be headed to even higher prices shortly. Under the Alaska Constitution, we as legislators have a duty to ensure that Alaska's resources are used to the maximum benefit of the Alaskan people. And I do not believe that that is, it'd be the maximum benefit for Alaskans to be charged higher prices for Alaskan petroleum products than people in the lower 48 states. So I urge the committee to act quickly and adopt the friendly amendment and move this bill onto the next committee so that Alaska businesses and families don't have to wait another year to get lower fuel prices. And that's just a basic introduction. My committee aide, David Dunsmore, has some more information that he would like to talk to you about, and then we'll get to some questions.
Welcome, David. I believe it's your first time for Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Dunsmore. I'm the Chief of Staff for Representative Peterson. I just want to quickly go through some of the issues and counter-arguments we've heard about this bill and why we don't think that...
Actually, I don't think we've had any counter-arguments on your bill yet because this is the first time it's been heard.
I think the one is just the people have philosophical objections towards government regulation of commerce. But this bill would simply add to a list of 55 things that the state has already deemed to be unfair trade practices. There's already a long list of regulation of trade practices. This would simply add a 56th. Another issue that we've heard, and sorry that we didn't distribute this information earlier, but we didn't think it was quite relevant that Hawaii had a law to address pricing, but their mechanism was substantially different from this bill. They actually had their equivalent of the RCA was tasked every single week to set a cap on the prices, and that isn't what this bill does. This simply prohibits excessive or exorbitant prices and establishes an objective threshold where the burden of proof would shift to the seller to show that their prices are justified by their expenses. Since I understand that there has been discussion of the Hawaii bill, we do have a handout that shows the effect of the Hawaii law on gasoline prices. The Hawaii law regulated gasoline prices, but not diesel. So to look at the effect of the Hawaii law, you can compare the price of gasoline with the price of diesel. And the first page is just the chart of Hawaii gasoline retail sales. And in the bottom, we show the time periods in which the Hawaii law was in place. And the Hawaii law had the unfortunate timing of taking place, coming and being implemented immediately after Hurricane Katrina. So obviously the prices were pretty high. And then afterwards, up until the point where the law was repealed, they did take a substantial dip. And then on the next page, we can show what diesel prices did in the same time period. And on the national average, the diesel prices, the yellow line is the...
Representative Chenault?
Let me finish, and then I've had a question.
Well, briefly, I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Representative Coghill. And additionally, there is information on the Hawaiian episode in the bill packet.
You see that the yellow line shows the U.S. average prices for diesel, which largely track with what Hawaii saw, which is a spike after Katrina, followed by a decline. The yellow and the blue, or the pink and the blue lines represent Honolulu and statewide prices in Hawaii. And they were not regulated by the Hawaii legislation, and they did not experience the diesel decline that they did for gasoline. But I think it is important to note that this bill is fundamentally different from the Hawaii bill. The Hawaii law actually had a committee that went and set prices. This bill would simply establish that it would be an unfair trade practice to charge excessive or exorbitant prices, and it would have an objective threshold over which the burden of proof would shift. But it's not a hard cap. It's simply a threshold where the burden of proof would shift to the sellers. I think we've had some question about why Washington State was picked as the state to index it to, and that was simply because Hawaii or Alaska and Washington, you know, have traditionally been linked commercially, and Washington does have a competitive refinery market and Alaska doesn't. So the idea was to find out what, to pick a place that has a competitive refinery market to use as the index. So we, and they used another Pacific Northwest state. It has been suggested that the prices will just decline on their own as the price of crude has gone down, but that isn't the case. We just handed out a handout of the retail state prices minus the state taxes, and it shows that when you take state taxes out, Alaska is radically higher than any other state in the country, even states that have no oil industry. And most of the oil that's the petroleum that's refined in Alaska is ANS crude or Cook Inlet, or made from ANS crude or Cook Inlet crude. And there's been some concern that this is somehow the sponsors of this bill are intending to badmouth or accuse refiners or distributors of nefarious conduct, and that's just not the case. The point of this bill is to protect Alaskan consumers and Alaskan businesses from excessive fuel prices. Obviously, for-profit corporations have a fiduciary duty to make the profits they can within the bounds of the law. So the point of this bill is to set the boundaries such that excessive or exorbitant prices are prohibited.
Representative Lynn.
Is that not price fixing then? If they're required to set the price so they're not too much?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, this
how'd you word that?
The bill, the language of the bill states that excessive or exorbitant prices are prohibited, and then it establishes that it's prima facie evidence of an unfair trade practice under that section. If the prices were 10% higher than the Washington average, but that's not a set price or a cap. It's simply an objective threshold. There's provisions of the bill that establish that that's a rebuttable presumption by showing that the expenses justify the higher cost. This bill doesn't set the price. It simply prohibits excessive or exorbitant prices.
Follow up?
And once again, please help me understand, how do you define excessive or exorbitant? Automatic, just at 10%. How do you define excessive or exorbitant?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, the term excessive or exorbitant was taken from an Idaho law, I believe. They have a consumer protection law prohibiting excessive or exorbitant prices, and those are legal terms.
They're not just words. I mean, what did that mean? So we copied that from, well, you said Idaho?
I believe it was Idaho.
And what did they set it on?
The point of, through the chair, Representative Lynn, the point is not to not be in the business of price setting, but to simply prohibit excessive or exorbitant prices. So, yes, that would be in the event that a case under this law would make it in the court system, that would be something that would have to be, you know, decided by the trier of fact. But the point, the sponsors of this bill did not want to get into the business of setting or capping prices because they understand that markets can fluctuate. But it just felt that it's needed to have some sort of reasonable protection, and the idea is that excessive or exorbitant prices should be prohibited.
Well, that's about it, but I still don't understand what exorbitant is. I guess if I can't afford it, it's exorbitant.
Representative Wimp, through the chair, the reason that we came up with the 10% numbers, we had gone back and looked at what the traditional price differential between prices in Washington State and Alaska had been, and we found that on very few occasions had there ever been more than a 10% differential up until last year, and then ever since then it's been significantly more than that, and that's why we set the 10% as the price threshold, and it is a triggering mechanism. It's not a price setting mechanism. So we're saying that traditionally prices that would be 10% more than what they're paying in Washington State would be exorbitant compared to what historically they have been here in Alaska. And so that, I guess, would be the definition of exorbitant in this bill.
So anything 10% above would be exorbitant, basically.
Right.
Okay. Representative Peterson, do you have a copy of the bill packet with you by chance? Specifically, the Ledge research document dated March 12th. I asked Ledge Research to compare a number of items between Anchorage and Seattle. And if you bear with me, transportation costs are roughly 11% of the household expenditures in both cities, of which gasoline and diesel are probably major components. Food is 12.5% of the monthly household expenditures, and utilities, which I would assume would be electrical and natural gas, are about 10%. All three of those items are at least 10% higher than Alaska or Anchorage. Should we be including those in too, because they would fall underneath your definitions by costing more than 10% of above Seattle prices?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
should we roll those in too?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't gone back to look at what traditionally the difference has been for groceries or housing or utilities over
the
last
year.
Actually,
it's better now than it used to be. Virtually on all of them, I think that would be safe to. To assume. I think we're getting more competitive now, but even still, we're looking at a significant difference, particularly on food.
And Mr. Chair, one of the main differences between refined petroleum products and some of the items listed in this research report are that, one, the state of Alaska has a constitutional obligation to make sure our resources are used to the maximum benefit of Alaskans. That doesn't necessarily exist for other consumer goods. And most of the petroleum being sold in Alaska comes from Alaska. And it doesn't come from the lower 48, as many of the other items compared on that chart do. Also, gasoline and heating oil and diesel is what is known economically as a demand inelastic, that there's when the prices go up, you know, there's only marginal choices that people can make as to what not to buy. People are still going to have to pay to heat their homes. They might be able to turn the thermostat down a couple of degrees. So they're going to have to a large extent, eat whatever cost increases happen.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't see it on here, but I kind of like the chart, but I was curious, is do you have a chart there that shows what the crude oil price was during those same time periods along that chart line, or do you know, is there a chart available to be able to get that? I'd just be interested to see.
Representative Chanel, through the chair, we don't have one with us right now, but we can certainly get you that.
Okay. And just, thank you, Mr. Chairman, just for some clarification, on your legislative research services, is the 29%, that is how much more it costs in Seattle than it does in Anchorage? Is that correct?
Are you talking about mine or theirs?
On yours.
No, 29% is the portion of household income. Okay. So the difference between on housing, for example, would be 14-15% cheaper than Seattle in Anchorage.
Right.
On groceries, 142% to 117%.
Well, I understood that. That's why I was saying it was cheaper to live in Anchorage.
That's why I didn't mention housing is something we should throw into the
book. As long as I was reading into that right. And also, just for information, and I don't have the numbers, I certainly have the Tassau refinery in my district, so I take the facility that they have and all comments concerning them fairly seriously, but there's a number of other oil issues out there. Unbeknownst to a lot of Alaskans, we import foreign crude to this state, to our facility, to the Tassau facility. It used to be about a third, and I don't know what the numbers are. We'll talk with Tassau about that. Certainly, all the oil products that come out of Flint Hills and North Pole are ANS crude. And but certainly there's other fuel sources that are from out of state. I think most of the fuel down here in Southeast does come from Washington, and I may be mistaken on that, but I certainly think that a majority of that fuel does. And I also believe that some of that fuel is barged from Washington to other areas in rural Alaska. So I don't know what those numbers are. Certainly we have our refineries here. Whenever they get to testify, they'll tell us a little bit more about their business, and certainly it may help more people to know more about their business, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Book?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a question?
Not yet.
Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this up. It's a legitimate question that we've been trying to ask both in my district and beyond, and I do have two refineries in my district, so we push them pretty hard. We found out that in my particular area that they produced 15% of the gasoline for Alaska, and they traded with Tesoro. But what became apparent to me was that If it wasn't for the fact that we were selling jet fuel to the Anchorage Airport, the price of both diesel and gasoline for home heating use would be quite a bit higher, because in order for us to refine it at some economies of scale, we really need that flow through. So have you considered the exorbitancy of what it would cost to say, turn the refinery off and import oil because of not being able to stay in business to support this? If 10% above Seattle becomes exorbitant, that it would cause that kind of stress that they would just quit doing it. And then, of course, somebody's going to refine the fuel for the jet fuel, no doubt. But by the time they take it to Washington, refine it, and try to sell it back to Alaska, we could have another problem on our hands, including no airplanes. So I see this as a huge downward pressure on that. The benefit that I'm getting in the interior, though I would like lower prices, believe me, is that that refinery gets us fuel at a fairly decent price because of the amount of jet fuel. Have you considered that in your approach to this?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, I saw the report that was done by the Judiciary Committee, and they talked about jet fuel at great length in that report. And I realized that a large percentage of the fuel that is produced by both of our refineries is, in fact, jet fuel. But having been a businessman for many years, it seems to me that it would be an unusual business model to sell the majority of the product that you make at a very low margin and try to make up for it on the products that you sell less of. That just traditionally is not the way businesses are managed. Now, this may be a unique situation. I'm not sure. But the goal in mind here is not to shut down our state refineries, but we just are looking to find out more information as to try to find out why our prices have gone up and not come down like they just traditionally have done in the past. There is a graph that shows the price in prices here in Alaska compared to what the price of crude oil was. And traditionally, those lines have been moving in conjunction with each other. But last year, all of a sudden, there seemed to be a disconnect, and there's sort of a larger area of difference than what there had been in the past. And we just are wondering why, you know.
And Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
I have the same question. So I think you and I might come to different conclusions, but the business model, for example, in the gasoline report, it was true that I think it was Safeway that said they sell gas sometimes at a loss to get people in their doors to buy groceries. So the business model does work that way. but the other thing is that the commodity price itself is sold to two different markets, and so I think I'm probably more sympathetic to that than some may very well be, compared to what it would cost to, say, ship that in. The other thing is, since the Tesoro refinery ships probably produces the 85% part of the gasoline, the interior feels a little chafed that might be the case. But it's also true that we are burning our refining process with the very products off the gas, the TAPS line. So we're using the very costly fuel just to refine the fuel. Right. And so those two refineries have a whole different price model than those who get the privilege of burning natural gas to heat theirs. And so it would not be a surprise to me that where you had a whole different market dynamic of more use for gas than diesel, or more use for diesel than gas in the lower 48, where in the interior of Alaska you would have this problem of trying to burn enough to make just the right amount of gas and still keep your contracts going. It was kind of an interesting balancing act. Mm-hmm. And so the lag there, it follows, I think, very well the price of the barrel of oil that they had to buy right off the TAPS line, and the lag for the contracts that they had and the products that they had to sell, I think, did start going down, just not as fast as I would have liked, nor you, obviously. So, but it made a case to me that it was not a price gouging, first of all. And so then the 10% question comes to mind. Is 10% the right number? Maybe we need to move that number up so that if there is a real market lag, that we're saying, hey, look, this is exorbitant at this index. And so I'm open to discussion to moving the index number around and seeing how that might look. But at this point, 10% is too close to the market range, in my view.
Representative Book, followed by Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was kind of surprised to learn in some of the discussions recently that, if you could clarify this in some of the discussions as well, Mr. Sponsor, that the jet fuel is actually globally priced, and that is established on a global market. And so I'm trying to get some clarification here. We have several different things that come into play here when we're talking about pricing. Could you clarify that for me?
Representative Book, through the chair, I have thought about this at great length because this was something that was brought up in the judiciary report that jet fuel is king, and that they were having to keep their jet fuel prices low to keep competition from shipping up jet fuel from the Lower 48. And when I started thinking about it, I'm going, well, you know, by the time you pay to ship a barge load of jet fuel up from the Lower 48, that, you know, that's going to add another 10 or 15 or maybe 20 cents a gallon to that jet fuel. Certainly, the planes are not going to turn around once they land in Anchorage and fly back to Seattle to fill up with fuel. That makes no sense. So I'm trying to understand why the price of jet fuel as a world commodity would work the way it's working in Alaska, because we are a little isolated, being sort of up here on the top of the world, and we do have a lot of demand for jet fuel because of all the companies like FedEx and the forwarding companies that have set up shop in around the state, and especially at the Anchorage Airport. So normally when you have a high demand for a product, sometimes that will cause the price to go higher. But the fact that they're selling 60% of their the product that they refine is jet fuel, and that product they're having an extremely small profit margin on to try to be competitive, and then passing to try to turn their profit by charging a higher price on the consumer fuels like heating fuel or diesel or gasoline. Traditionally, that doesn't make sense to me. Now, the Safeway analogy, Safeway will sell gasoline cheaper, but their number one product is not gasoline, it's groceries. They want to get you in there and fill that cart up with groceries. They can afford to give you 10 or 15 cents off a gallon at the pump. That's only going to cost them a couple bucks. So I think that's a little different analogy. But I'm not really 100% sure why there has been this world price for jet fuel in Alaska over a traditionally what you would call a locally competitive market situation. Does that answer your question?
Clear as mud.
Representative Newman.
I'm glad you're drinking the same water I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson. When I read this, it talks about sales of certain energy resources by Alaska refiners. And when I look at my map here and I look at Southeast, Western Alaska, a lot of all those fuel provided there come from Washington, not refined in the state. So how do you, and then you got transportation costs, and getting, I mean, how do you figure all that in? How do you go through all that calculations of what's gouging or not? How do you set up that structure?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the Energy Committee actually talked about this when we had the RCA in front of us here a while ago, and I don't have the Regulatory Commission of Alaska mentioned in this as being the organization that would be looking into this. I actually thought it might be better to use the Attorney General, since he was the one that was doing the investigation on fuel prices. And we were actually, when I filed this, we were still waiting for his report to come out. But the Regulatory Commission did mention that they thought that it was within their purview to look at fuel prices in monopolistic type situations in rural and western Alaska. And so if we as a body would ask the Regulatory Commission to look into that, they would be required to, because they think that it would be something that falls under their...
If I may, Mr. Chair, you work with the RCA every day, but RCA regulates utility companies, not gas producers or refineries.
Well, and not all utility companies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And not all utility
companies. Missing one up in Fairbanks.
But I don't think you answered my question. My question was, if this gas is refined or fuel is refined in Seattle, what type of structure do you set up to look at all the transportation costs if I'm getting it up in the Anoka River system? There's a lot of different steps that has to go through there. And so if you say, okay, everybody can make 10% profit, 20%, 12%, who decides that? I mean, because that has to go through different steps to get there. That's how it gets to $9 a gallon.
Right.
Every time it's handled, somebody else has to, that's the economies of scale, that's what they do, that's just business. But how do you, what system do you have in place? I mean, if we were to pass this, that would put everything in a turmoil. How do you, what system do you have in mind to regulate all that?
Representative Newman, through the chair, well, we actually have Ledge Legal drawing up an amendment, a friendly amendment, that would include distributors in this bill, because after traveling to Western Alaska and hearing testimony out in several parts of the state, they were feeling that, you know, even though traditionally their prices had been higher out there because of shipping, that they were higher than what they felt was reasonable as well. And and part of that they thought might have been the fact that they only had one company that was storing and selling fuel to their town or to their village or in a certain geographical area. So there is a need out there, from what I've been told. The people out there in that part of Alaska feel that prices are exorbitant as well, and they would like to get to the bottom of that. And so that's why I'm willing to accept a friendly amendment to include distributors in this bill.
Well, I'm still haven't got the answer that I asked was, what type of system would be set up to look at this, to look at everybody who has to touch this? Can they only make 10%? Can they only make 15%? How would that be structured? And I understand, I think my gas prices are too high too, and my fuel prices are too high too. Who doesn't in this state? But what system do you have, would you have in place in a friendly amendment that says, well, we're just going to put distributors on this? Doesn't tell me what structure. If you're going to have legislation like this, you should have a structure set up that says, that has that. I mean, you have to be able to look at that and know exactly how it's going to work. What do you have in mind for that? Do you have that?
Well, Representative Newman, through the chair, the trading mechanism is 10% at this particular time. Now, if someone wanted to amend that and make it higher, like Representative Coghill had mentioned earlier, he thought 10% might have been too close to what the traditional average had been, and he thought maybe 15% would be better. That would be up to the committee. I actually would have to go back and look at that and see if I thought 15% was better. But there, you know, we need to have some sort of a triggering mechanism, I think, to cause an investigation at some point, or otherwise prices just could go out of control. There would be no control.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I tried to ask for what type of structure would be in place to get this, and maybe there's not one there. That, and if there's not one there, just then there's not one there. But
the Attorney General would be doing an investigation.
If I may continue, if we just go 10% above Seattle, or even 15% above Seattle, trying to get it to different locations, there's a lot of different mechanisms in there. And do you have 10% in each person, or I don't see a structured mechanism on how you look at this. And that's what I guess the courts would have to decide. Is that your intention? Is the courts decide?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the Attorney General's is the office that I have listed in this bill as to investigating if an event had been triggered. But for certain parts of the state, I think the Regulatory Commission probably would be a better way to go, as because they are used to dealing with, they deal with utilities right now, but if there's only one supplier to a certain area, one would, by definition, we might have to consider that person to be a utility if they're the only one that is providing. So
that circles. Thank you, Mr.
I'd like to make a comment. Ed Sniffen, the AG that handles these issues is in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately is not available online today. We tried to get him, and he has a pressing engagement that prevents him from being with us today, at least online. When we hear the bill again next week, we'll hopefully have that available for questions.
Okay.
Representative Lynn?
Doesn't the Attorney General investigate these matters now? Didn't they just have an investigation? So this would be, as I understand it, would mandate an investigation if it is, quote, exorbitant, unquote, or above 10%. But don't they already investigate these matters? And didn't they just do one? Or am I mistaken?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, they did do an investigation, but that was to see if there had been price fixing or collusion. Excuse me, and that's a different threshold than what we're setting here.
Well,
colluding would mean companies had gotten right together and had made some sort of coordinated plan to set prices at a certain level. And that's traditionally has been very, very hard to prove, and because they've tried to look into that at previous times in the history of Alaska and have yet to
find help. How could you have an exorbitant price unless there was something nefarious going on? I mean, what causes the price to be exorbitant? However you define exorbitant, exorbitant means something is unusual, something is out of order here.
Right.
And the logical thing would be, well, there's some kind of collusion, some kind of, you know, something is going on the AG would need to look at, right? So why else would they? Just for curiosity or what?
Well, through the chair, Representative Lynn, the Attorney General's report concluded that, there was nothing illegal going on under current Alaska law, because there is no law against exorbitant prices now. But the Attorney General also concluded that we do not have a competitive refinery market in Alaska. We have what's known as an oligopoly, which is where several large firms control the market. And so since there isn't a competitive market force driving the price that would ordinarily regulate the prices as they do in places like Washington where they have competitive refinery markets, this bill would allow, would prohibit excessive or exorbitant prices that could arise because there is no competition causing a downward pressure on prices. While for most goods, there is competitive pressure on prices, but in Alaska for refined petroleum, there isn't a competitive market.
And just one more. So why did they initiate the investigation? Did they think things were exorbitant? Is that why they initiated? Agents could wake up one morning, say, "I think I'll investigate this." Why did they investigate it? Did they think it was exorbitant, or why?
Well, through the chair, Representative Lynn, I mean, they were investigating it under current Alaska law. They obviously wouldn't have been looking at to whether they violated laws of this bill, since this bill has yet to become law. And what they concluded was that there was no evidence of collusion or illegal activities under current law.
On that point, I was sitting in the committee when we had that report delivered to us. The Attorney General said we do not have a price gouging law, and so the collusion issue was the only thing that they could look into. But what he did say was that a price gouging law is usually event driven, Katrina or some other event, and they're event driven, and then you look into those circumstances where they're profiteering off of somebody else's bad circumstances. And so it looks like this bill tries to even that out by saying the event in Alaska is no competition, and therefore we have to index ourselves to somebody. I don't know that I agree with the approach, but I understand the process. But that's based on what the Attorney General said.
Right, and if I may,
Representative Lynn, followed by Representative Boot.
Well, that's okay, but I mean, there's nothing in here that has about events, there's some catastrophe, or so this doesn't address that. doesn't address catastrophes, it's special events.
Right.
Representative Booth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I recall, didn't we ask for the Attorney General to give us a report?
I believe so, but I think I'd rather wait till...
Pardon me? Oh.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
I thought it was the governor that requested the AG to...
Right.
I believe you're correct.
Yeah. That's where this, through the chair, that's where this report came from, was that the governor requested the AG to look into this because of the public outcry. So that's where generated this report.
Okay.
Representative Leon.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would have to say that there are many consumers out there right now who think that the prices that they're being charged for fuel is a catastrophe. Because they're trying to figure out how they can afford to heat their homes up in the central part of Alaska. And in rural Alaska, I was myself there watching people pump fuel out at $6.51 a gallon. It doesn't take very long to add up when you're filling your tank at $6.51 a gallon. And there's places that we're paying twice that much at points in this winter. So there is a problem with the cost of fuel from the consumer's point of view. And the reason that I brought forth this bill was because I do believe that Alaska consumers do deserve some protection from exorbitant prices. And we set the threshold at the 10%. Maybe 15% would be better. That would be, you know, up to, you know, to the committees to decide if they wanted to change that number. I'm open to listening to those possibilities.
All right, thank you.
Representative Booth?
I don't have any follow-up, sir. Thank you.
I believe you have one person that you invited to testify, at least one. The only one that's online is Bob Weinstein. Is he still with us? Or do you have anything further you would like to add before we...
No, Mr. Chair. Yeah. He could go next.
Bob Weinstein, are you with us, Bob?
I still am. I've been listening to the conversation.
Please state your name and affiliation, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you very much. My name is Bob Weinstein. I am mayor of the city of Ketchikan, and I just want to briefly speak in general support of the concept that's embodied in the bill. There was a lot of concern in Ketchikan last November and December about what appeared to be an unusually high disparity between plunging prices for gasoline and fuel oil and the lower 48 and the prices here, which remain much higher. The issue was the topic of quite a few angry letters to the newspaper and other media, as well as letters, phone calls, and emails to legislators. Finally, the concern became so great that in December, there was actually picketing and protest of high prices. And while it may be coincidental, on that day, prices at the pump dropped between $1 and $1.40 per gallon. While the causes of possible exorbitant pricing here may be different than the causes elsewhere in Alaska, the concerns are similar, and that's really the point that I want to make. In my opinion, a bill like HB 68 will do at least two things. First, it seems that it will give the Attorney General a new tool which can be used to protect Alaska consumers in the event that a refiner does charge exorbitant or excessive prices. And second, the very fact that such a tool exists, that the Attorney General has a new tool, might in and of itself deter a refiner from selling energy resources at exorbitant or excessive prices. And that's the end of my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for the mayor?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hey, Bob, good to hear from you. Is the fuel that's brought into Ketchikan, is that brought up from Washington, or is it?
Yes, it comes up by barge.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Caroline Powell, are you with us? Ms. Powell?
Yes.
You've been asked to testify by the sponsor of the bill. Could you please identify yourself and your affiliation?
Okay. Representative Peterson, a member of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Caroline Powell. My husband and I own and operate Malott's General Store in Yakutat and have for over 40 years. Our electric bill has normally been about $4,000 a month. It swelled to $17,000 one month due to high fuel surcharge. Our average increase in the surcharge only, not including the electric bill, is $200 a day, or $6,000 a month, or $72,000 a year. We won't be able to survive at these rates. The community has no purchasing dollars left after paying fuel surcharge on their power bills, plus the high cost of home heating fuel. The surcharge on a residential electric bill of $270 is $400, making it over $600 total. 100 gallons of home heating fuel costs about over $500. If Malott's General Store has to close, the effects on Yakutat would evolve into greater losses, the losses of jobs to our employees and families and to those we help throughout the winter, and a loss of sales tax to the city and borough. The local fishing fleet cannot go out fishing. Gas is $5 a gallon. A non-local halibut boat just delivered his catch this week to our local fish processor. After the skipper paid for his fuel, he said he won't be returning, and others won't be as well. Consequently, the halibut boats will not be shopping at our store either. No sales makes less sales tax. Delta Western bought fuel. They are the only distributor here. They bought fuel and filled their tanks in Yakutat when the price was at the highest. As I said, they don't have any competition. Doing the math, if you sell $2 fuel at 10% profit, you make 20 cents. If you sell $5 fuel at the same profit, you make 50 cents or 30 cents more. Delta Western is the only fuel company in Yakutat and is therefore a monopoly. And I thought the state has an obligation to protect consumers under monopoly. The mayor talked with Delta Western, informing them that the power company could bring in cheaper fuel from Seattle. The response was it would take the community longer then to buy up the higher cost fuel if the power company doesn't help purchase it. The power company did bring in cheaper fuel once or twice from Seattle. This week, the barge service bringing cheaper fuel from Seattle is canceled due to weather. The power company is forced to purchase fuel from Delta Western again, and they increased the cost to the power company by 30 cents a gallon as they are no longer on the preferred list or entitled to the utility rate. Consequently, our electricity is going to go up even higher. Yakutat needs some relief, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Powell. Any questions for Ms. Powell? Representative Booth?
Thank you. Really appreciate your testimony, and that is why we're in these committees and doing due diligence with these deliberations. Where exactly does that oil and your fuel come from when it gets delivered from Yakutat on a normal basis?
I don't know where Delta Western gets their fuel normally, but it can be brought in from Seattle cheaper on AML at
I assume so.
Oh, a lot cheaper. And Delta Western has basically said they won't be dealing with anyone who does this.
Well, thanks again, Ms. Bell. Well, I think at this point.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You may want to stay online. We have Tesoro coming up next.
Okay.
Followed by Foothills and the Alaska Railroad. Please join us, gentlemen.
We're going to bring Pete back up a couple times.
Two or three times. Gentlemen, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lynn Westfall, and I'm the Senior Vice President for External Affairs and Chief Economist for Tesoro Petroleum Corporation out of San Antonio.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kip Knutson. I'm Manager of External Affairs for Tesoro, Alaska.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. And let me begin by thanking the Chairman and the members of asking me to be here today. As many of you know, Tesoro is an independent refiner, which means that we don't own any crude oil, but we have to purchase the entire need for our refineries on the free market from third parties. Because of this, we don't make money necessarily at high gasoline prices. We make profit on the difference in price between gasoline and the other products we sell and the price we have to pay for crude oil. Last year, when the headlines were filled with news about the large profits being made in the oil companies, those were profits being made by crude producers. Last year was one of the worst years for profitability in history for the refining business. And the outlook for the refining industry as a whole is continuing to deteriorate. Last year, gasoline demand in the United States declined 3.5%, which was its second worst decline since 1965. Jet fuel demand is down over 10%, a larger decline than we saw in the aftermath of the 9/11 incident. U.S. refineries are only running at about 80% of capacity versus a historical average in the 90s. But overseas, refineries continue to be built. Last month, one of the largest refineries in the world started up in the country of India. That refinery alone can provide enough gasoline to fill 40% of the U.S.'s requirements for imports. The Chinese are building between 4 and 5 refineries a year, some of which will be dedicated for the export market. And many refineries are in the planning stage in the Middle East. I think the final word that can be said on the state of the industry can be had simply by looking at our stock price. A little over a year ago, the stock of Tesoro was at about $60 a share. About a month and a half ago, it went down to 6, and it has only recovered to about 15. This is not a healthy industry. This is certainly not an industry that's earning very high profits. But I may be sounding like someone from Wall Street asking for a bailout, and that's not really why I'm here. Refining is the industry we've chosen to be in. It's the industry we will continue to be in as long as we face risks and uncertainties that we have experience and comfort in dealing with. Within our system of 7 refineries, our refinery in Nikiskie and the Alaska market as a whole are core to us. We were the only refinery in the state to invest to make the new ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, and that was an investment of about $65 million. To ensure that this product had a home and that all markets were served, we entered into a unique marketing arrangement with Flint Hills, whereby a large portion of our production of this fuel went to them to sell to their customers. We face another capital requirement of similar size coming in the coming years to remove the benzene content in gasoline. This time, however, we could be facing a new risk, and one that we're very uncomfortable with taking. And that risk is the bill before you today, which attempts to stop a perceived practice of price gouging by instituting a cap on the price of gasoline and other petroleum products. Not only do such requirements not work, where they have been tried, they've had the opposite effect to what they've intended. In the late 70s, oil was placed under price controls, and where I lived in Texas, we had gasoline lines and even odd filling days, depending on the last number of your license plate. Every single study that has ever been done on that time period concluded that the shortages were caused by price controls, not by the oil embargo by the Middle East countries. A more recent example, which you've heard from others, was the attempt by the state of Hawaii to institute price caps on gasoline. Shortly after they were instituted, a hurricane on the Gulf Coast made the Gulf Coast price for gasoline go from being the lowest in the world to being one of the highest. But because there was a cap on prices in Hawaii could not rise high enough to compete for limited volumes of gasoline available. The result was gasoline left the state of Hawaii. So you can control the price, but if you do at a level that can't compete with the rest of the world, we have an obligation for our corporation to send it to another market. The Hawaii regulation is now in abeyance and, as you know, is not being enforced. Price caps don't work because you can't outguess or forecast the market. It is a world market for crude. It's a world market for petroleum products. And a piece of legislation can't compete with a daily decision-making process of millions of consumers worldwide. And just as price caps don't work, neither do vague terms like exorbitant or excessive. I think one of the basic tenets of our legal system is that we have to have enough clarity in our laws that someone knows ahead of time that a contemplated action is illegal so he can change his behavior before breaking the law. Having government officials tell us after the fact that our actions were illegal because the law is vague is a very great risk to ask us to bear. In conclusion, let me just say that the Soar Corporation has and would like to continue investing in our assets in the state of Alaska. But since we have limited capital and we have to choose the best places to use that resource, we have to consider business risks. And the bill before you today would add a new risk to our decision-making process. Thank you very much for your time, and I expect I'll get a question or two.
You get at least one. If this bill had been enacted a year ago, would you be in business in Alaska at this point in time?
Certainly we would be in business. I don't mean to imply that there's going to be an immediate effect to this bill. What the effect will be on our long-term investment decision. Had this bill been in effect at the time we were looking at the decision to invest the $65 million to make the ultra-low sulfur diesel, it would have been a factor. I can't go back in history and tell you it would have decided otherwise, but it would certainly have been something we would have looked at in making that decision.
Second question is, what is the current makeup of the oil that you're using at the Nikiski refinery?
In general, about 50% is ANS, about 25% is Cook Inlet, which we buy all the Cook Inlet production, and the remaining 25% is worldwide. We have run crudes from Russia, Middle East, Far East for that remaining 25%.
So 25% of it is clean oil, or the Cook Inlet oil, which is what your plant was set up.
Yeah, it was originally built to, and configured to run Cook Inlet. Correct.
Representative Coghill, Book.
It sounds to me that in taking a refinery, you have to buy the refined fuel at whatever the market price is going. So you have a pretty good idea of your fixed cost, but what you don't have a good idea on is how much you're going to buy the crude for refining, what the market will bear, and how we'll regulate you. I mean, those are the three basic pieces of it, I would suppose. So do you suppose that rather than looking at price gouging on refineries, we should be looking at the more upstream, at those that when the market price changed, that we could say they're in fact gouging everybody, refiners, consumers, everybody? Is that something that has been looked at in your knowledge in history? Something I haven't really given a whole lot of thought to, but I know when Congress looked at it, I think that was part of what they were trying to look at.
As I recall, in the initial stages of the debate on the Hawaii law, they looked at putting the cap at the retail level instead of the wholesale, but decided that, in effect, they would be hurting smaller businessmen by doing that, so they kept it at the wholesale level. I think overall it has the same chilling effect. Eventually, each chain in the supply chain has to make a reasonable profit. If you try and limit any chain, you're going to damage that part, be it the wholesale chain or the retail chain or the refining chain. So I don't think by moving the point of enforcement significantly changes what the impact of the bill would have been or would be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem is when somebody is taking advantage of a run-up like that, then those who make the most amount of profit, and I think this is what Congress is getting at, was those who are going to make this huge windfall, that somehow it should be either levelized or they're fined into it. And I think Congress brought some of the major producers before them and began to ask a question about, and I think it was the Katrina event that spurred the whole thing. And since price gouging is usually event-driven, that seems a reasonable place to start. So I was thinking, with based on your testimony, that the fixed costs being what they are, I mean, you got plant management, you got the hardware, you got the cost of using fuel to burn for refining, pretty fixed cost. So then it's what you buy the crude for that is the issue. Are we barking up the wrong tree, or is the market so complex from where you buy your oil that you can't find a indexing point?
The answer to your question, I believe, is that I would love to tell you we're a cost-plus business, where you can take the cost of crude, add in our refinery manager's salary, adding 10%, and that is or should be the price of gasoline. Unfortunately, the crude oil market has its own supply and demand factors worldwide. For instance, it certainly wasn't U.S. demand that drove the price up to $140 a barrel. That was Chinese demand. Gasoline has its own supply and demand characteristics, either at the international level or even down to the store across the street level. And they move in different directions, so there really is no tie between at this crude price, gasoline should be at this price. So, as I say, they're really different, but both are global supply and demand factors that you have to account for. And I can't tell you today, I'm certainly not smart enough, what the relationship between any two markets should be tomorrow. People have talked about Pacific Northwest looking back in history. I don't know what that relationship will be next year. Washington State is out of compliance with federal ozone standards, and they're going to have to come up with a compliance plan, and part of that plan may be instituting California-grade gasoline, which is a whole different animal when it comes to gasoline. If they do that, you can take your historical charts and throw them away. The relationship will change. But I guess my point is, I don't know next year what any of those relations are going to be. And to assume a cap or to regulate it is something that I don't have the brains to tell you what it ought to be.
Paulo?
Mr. Chairman, it would be helpful to me, since you have refineries that are kind of scattered around the Northwest and one in Hawaii, to help me understand a little bit of the dynamics of your buying and selling. If we're going to index Washington, for example, I know that we have a different population base, we have a different distribution system. How many other refineries will you compete with on the Northwest that service the Washington market? I think you've got one in California, one in Washington.
Sure.
How many others in that Northwestern are going to you're going to compete with? And then the other thing is the volume flow of diesel and gasoline. Give us some concept of when you have too much diesel or too much gas. How do you as refiners gauge when you're going to turn the heat up for gas and turn the heat up for diesel?
As to your first, if you're asking about overall competition in refining or just our refineries?
Overall. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have refineries, as you know, Alaska, Hawaii, north of Seattle, and of course, we actually have two in California.
Okay.
We have Northern California and Southern California. As I recall, there are 13 refineries in California. There are four in Washington. There, you know about Alaska. There are two in Hawaii. But let me also say that just because you have a refinery in one location, you compete with a lot of other people. For instance, there is a pipeline that joins Salt Lake City to eastern Washington State. So part of supply actually comes in from there. There is a pipeline that comes from El Paso, Texas to Arizona, and there's a pipeline that goes from California to Arizona. So those two markets meet in there. So it's very hard to draw a supply corridor that's very narrow. Once you put product into a tank, as we do in Alaska, we can send it anywhere in the world by putting it on a ship. But that's the competition for the refining just in that area.
And Mr. Chairman, all I'm trying to get at is if we say we're got to be 10 or 15 or 40% even to be exorbitant, I want to know what's the market dynamic that we're going to index to and how similar is it to Alaska that we could gauge 10% number, for example, because the price at the pump is what we continue to look at, but we don't, the distribution system and the consumption rates are going to be quite different, I would think.
I would tell you that every market is unique. Certainly Alaska is smaller, it's more geographically diverse, it's spread out. I can't find another market that looks like Alaska. The closest would probably be Hawaii, but it has its own unique characteristics in that it has no crude oil. Everything has to be shipped in. They have no natural gas. Their utilities run on crude oil. So,
on that point,
yes.
You're buying 25% on the spot market
for Alaska.
For Alaska,
correct.
How far out are you buying it? Is it like if, 60 days, 90 days?
It depends on the location. If you're buying in South America, it's anywhere between 30 and 45 days. If you're buying from the Middle East, it can be upwards of 90 days.
Okay, so you're either buying high or you're getting it low, one or the other. You're not getting it in the middle.
Yeah, you're not. The crude that's arriving today, we bought at a price other than today's price.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming forth. You're really helping us scratch down to some of the real questions we need to be asking, I believe. So thank you very much. I do have a couple questions, if you'd bear with me. One of them is, through the chair, who are your customers? Who are your consumers? Who do you sell to? I know it isn't just to Alaska. So I when you were in my office, I asked you for your line card and, you know, to include that flow chart of how you guys work, where your business operates, and as well, where does your product go?
Is this just for Alaska or our entire system?
Well, I would like to know, as an example, where does your product go that comes out of the Nikiski plant, Tesoro?
Okay, on the gasoline side, and these numbers are approximate, I don't know exactly what they are today, I believe about 60% of our gasoline production actually goes to what you would call other refiners. Since our refinery is the only one in the state that produces a large percentage of gasoline, even though you're picking up at a Shell station or another station, those molecules came from our refinery. Other than that, we sell to wholesalers who have their own brand. Guy down the street with Joe's service station gets his gasoline from us, as well as, of course, the Alaska brand comes from us. So we sell to all channels in the trade. On the diesel side, I think I mentioned earlier, a large portion of our diesel production goes to Flint Hills, another refiner, to supply to their customers, as well as we supply to wholesale, to bulk marine customers. On the jet fuel side, of course, it goes to the airport. And then about 30% of what we make is called heavy oil, which is something that we have to export at a loss. We sell it for less than the cost of crude. I can provide you with a more detail. That's what I have off of my memory, if that answers your question.
Paul, if I might, yes, partially. Do you also export some of that to other places in the world that comes out of Tesoro?
From Alaska, no, not really. It's mostly the bottom of the barrel stuff is almost uniquely a Far East market, so almost all production on the West Coast has to go over there.
I have other questions, but I don't want to monopolize.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to get Jeff Cook on from Flint Hills to give us a different perspective, unless there are any further pressing questions for Tesoro.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Jeff, are you still with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jeff Cook. I'm Director of External Affairs for the Flint Hills Resources Alaska Refinery, located at 1100 H&H Lane in North Pole. I thank you for inviting us to testify in response to House Bill 68. We appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns about this legislation, which we believe will adversely affect our business, harm consumers, and have long-term negative implications for the people of Alaska. Before I continue, I'd like to provide the committee with information about our operation that is fundamental to this discussion and we hope helpful as you consider House Bill 68. First, it is important to understand that Flint Hills Resources is not in the crude production business, nor do we own retail stations. All of our products are sold on the wholesale market. It is also important to note that we make less than one-fifth of the gasoline used in Alaska and only a third of the heating fuel used in the Fairbanks area. Our 175 employees are very proud of their contributions to Alaska. We run a very efficient and a very safe refinery for which we've received recent awards and recognition. Flint Hills Resources has more than 60 years of experience in the refining business. We've owned and operated the North Pole Refinery since 2004. Our company also owns and operates refineries in Minnesota and Texas. The North Pole Refinery began operating in 1977, shortly after the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System was completed.
The system has gone, the facility has gone through various modifications over the years, but its basic configuration has remained unchanged. Our refinery is a topping plant, which means it lacks the sophisticated processing capability to refine all the crude oil coming into the plant into finished products. The North Pole Refinery takes in between 180,000 and 220,000 barrels of crude oil per day. We heat that crude to distill it into a few basic products that we retain to sell. The rest of the stream is then returned to TAPS, for which we pay a quality bank adjustment or penalty. As a result, we are currently keeping only about 40,000 barrels a day, some days less, of saleable products, the majority of which is jet fuel. In addition, we keep a quantity of fuel that is used as an energy source for heating the crude oil in the refining process, as we do not have access to natural gas. There were many topping plants operating in the United States when the North Pole Refinery opened in 1977. Now there are just a few. Increased environmental emissions regulations caused many topping plants to shut down, and increasingly stringent federal requirements on the types of fuels produced forced others to close. The North Pole Refinery has kept pace with new environmental regulations, but the changes in the types of fuels required has impacted the amount of gasoline and diesel fuel that we can produce at our facility. Federal mandates to lower sulfur content in the last few years have substantially diminished our ability to produce those two fuels. While the refinery still produces some gasoline and off-road diesel, we now buy gasoline and diesel from other sources in order to meet the full needs of our customers and meet the federal requirements on these fuels. Due in large part to these regulations there and their effect on the marketplace, supplies are tight and margins for refineries like ours are very small. As the committee is aware, our company is presently working with the Department of Natural Resources to develop a better understanding of our operation and the circumstances that threaten our long-term viability in the state. Even though our refinery had been profitable recently, that is not the case. That has not always been the case, and it is not the case currently. And we face a great deal of uncertainty about our future, and we explore our options with the state to deal with this uncertainty. House Bill 68, if it were to become law, would be a very serious threat to the future of the North Pole Refinery. House Bill 68 does not specify what are exorbitant or excessive prices, yet subjects refiners to penalties 10 times the amount of the economic benefit from an unlawful sale, or $50 million, whichever is greater. If enacted into law, this legislation will have a significant and adverse effect and impact on Alaska consumers and businesses. In fact, we believe such a measure would be so oppressive to our industry that Flint Hills Resources may be forced to cease refining and fuel distribution in the state because of the uncertainties of what prices violate the law and the burdensome penalties. No one questions that consumers can and should seek the lowest price for any commodity, including fuel. The process is mutually beneficial for both the consumer and the producer. Government intervention in pricing ultimately creates far more harm than good. Producers react to price control or price cap legislation in a number of ways, none of which are good for consumers. A producer may simply shut down facilities or make the product only when the controlled price makes a sale profitable. When it's time to consider investments needed to meet the new federal regulations, a key determinant of whether the investment will be made is whether the controlled price is sufficient to generate an acceptable rate of return. If it is not, the investment will not be made. Competing producers who are watching the market will only enter if they believe they can make money under the controlled price. All of this leads to one conclusion, shortages. A lower price is of no use to the consumer if there is no fuel available to buy. Trying to outguess the market by setting a price cap that is thought to be adequate to address these problems is a dangerous game and one we simply will not engage in. None of us can forecast the future with any degree of accuracy. And the consequences of being wrong is a shortage of fuel in Alaska, a dangerous situation. No one questions the good intentions of the drafters of this legislation, but I and my company implore you not to advance this legislation. While this legislation could shut down our facilities, the harm to Alaskans would be far greater. In closing, Flint Hills Resources understands that high fuel prices can be a hardship for many Alaska families. North Pole workers pay the same price for gasoline and heating fuel as everyone else, but price control legislation will harm consumers by causing shortages. Our refinery is facing serious challenges now with the demand for jet fuel, our primary product, down significantly in Alaska and particularly at the Anchorage International Airport. And this was recently evidenced by FedEx taking and transferring 68 pilots out of Anchorage. Such challenges to our refinery are serious enough without being further exacerbated by this legislation. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we respectfully request that you do not move this bill out of committee. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'd be pleased to answer any questions you have to the best of my ability and within the regulations that prohibit us from signaling price, operational, and other information to our competitors.
I see at least one question, Jeff. Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I really appreciate you coming forth with your testimony. I read a newspaper article a while back from your parent company, Cook Industries, and in that article, they stated that when the price of oil coming into them was high, they couldn't make any money. But there was no way to make a profit when the price was low. And at the time, I was confused. Is there some margin within those bounds that allows you to make a profit? Is there a certain price range for the cost of North Slope crude that allows you to be profitable?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I'm not an economist, and I've got to be careful talking about margins and ranges. For one thing, I'm not fully competent to talk about that. Another, we have certain restrictions on what we can say with other competitors in a public setting. I can tell you that when the prices were high, we were challenged because we do have to take, I think as Representative Coghill mentioned in an earlier comment, we have to take crude oil, refine it into a energy source to run the refinery. We don't have natural gas, and we were paying, three times the sort of the average cost for refiners in the country to heat up our crude and process it. The cost of energy is the second highest cost we have over crude. So, I can't really specifically answer your question, one, from a knowledge standpoint, two, from a legal standpoint.
Any further questions for Mr. Cook?
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Pat Gamble, Alaska Railroad. Are you still online, Pat?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. How do you read?
You're coming in great. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and tell us any concerns you may have about this bill, or if you support it, or...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. I appreciate the opportunity also to kind of piggyback on the presentations that have been made regarding House Bill 68, and while my discussion is not going to be as far-reaching as you've had regarding markets and the impacts on the price of gasoline specifically, I have been... over the last few years since 2004 in a close association with Flint Hills specifically, we've had a great business relationship with them on a macro basis, not just on the gasoline and heating oil, but of course we move that product to the airport, and I've come to know the company and some of their business, but I've also had the opportunity to get more involved in this initiative that we have underway with the Department of Natural Resources and Flint Hills Corporate to try to look at what options would provide viability for the state to keep the refinery open and look at all the options, which would include Flint Hills as well as other opportunities. The homework assignment that the Alaska Railroad got in that project has also given us an opportunity to look at what the impacts of the refinery would be, particularly if it wasn't there. And part of our process is to try to work with Flint Hills and DNR to build the value chain, as we call it, for the state of Alaska to determine what is in the best interests of all Alaskans with regard to the refining portion of the royalty oil or the oil that belongs to all Alaskans and do the best for all Alaskans. Building that value chain is very different for the state of Alaska than it is for private corporation Flint Hills. And it's actually the other side of the coin then that today I wanted to comment on, because in going into this assessment, it's given us a much clearer picture of the consequences of not having that refinery, because that's part of our homework assignment as well. And it just simply gets down to a business case. When you look at one value chain and compare it to the other and then present to you all the factual data that suggests how a decision might go with regard to the viability of the refinery itself. The other side of that coin, though, is sort of a fallout from the process I've just described. And that is, okay, what if we don't have a refinery in the interior? So what does that do for all Alaskans with regard to addressing the problem? If I write down who does the ARC, the railroad, depend on the most for its own viability, my answer is clearly Flint Hills. At the present time, they are our dominant customer. If I write down then in turn, well, who depends on the railroad for its viability, as you would guess, there's a long list of customers that extend all the way up and down the rail belt to include ports and companies, and it extends all the way to the North Slope in terms of support for the producers, gold mines, and, of course, the military in a large way, because we're part of STRACNET, which is a transportation strategic system, and we're a defense connector line, as it's called, in order to move the military back and forth in the state. And then, of course, there are several large projects that we have underway, and I know you're familiar with things like the Fairbanks Bypass or the Northern Line Extension or the Matsu Line Extension. The viability of the railroad is important to all these customers and projects because it's our financial capability and the ability to operate in areas such as engineering and design and construction and so on that allows all these customers and projects to look to the railroad as a tool for economic development, which is why we're here, and that's what our mission statement is. So I compare the two of them and I say, okay, take away Flint Hills. Now, why would I say that? Because it's in my estimation that knowing what I do about the Flint Hills operation in the process that we've undergone, I am convinced in my own mind as I do the business case and do the risk assessment, as you would any business case to compare it against another one if you were making investments, I am thoroughly convinced that House Bill 68 would be almost tantamount to a heart shot in terms of the opportunity to continue a reasonable dialogue with Flint Hills with the opportunity for a reasonable outcome and the ability to look at several reasonable options that would keep the refinery open. As I put this test up against some of the options we're looking at, in my assessment, I think it would be so egregious as to render some of those options just simply not worthwhile. That's of great concern because of the impact on the railroad. I've talked about this before, but just to remind you, you know, we have about 600 jobs involved here. That would include the Flint Hills refinery personnel plus a couple hundred on the railroad plus another couple 150 that ICER said in a recent study, in which we had updated last year, that would also be affected that are non-ARC jobs. There would be another 500 indirect jobs, sort of the second and third order effect on the employment. And why the reduction in these jobs? Well, it's because without that revenue coming into the railroad, not only does the payroll have to go down on the railroad because the business would go down significantly, but as you know, all our bottom line goes into capital projects. And once we pay our bills, we also, besides the payroll impact in the economy, we also then pump that capital money back into the economy as well. And just the payroll alone, both non-ARC payroll and ARC payroll, is probably in the $50 million a year category, not counting the dollars that are going into capital, which are probably half again as much as that each year. So when you're building the value chain again, and you look at the total value to all Alaskans as a result of resource development, that sort of higher order statement, from an Alaskan point of view, you have to add up these things that I've mentioned as far as the impact on the economy and as far as the jobs themselves, particularly in a time right now when we're trying to save jobs and get through some really tough times. So it's this perspective that I wish to bring to the committee. I don't see where the size of the disturbance in the Alaskan market of this magnitude really reduces the cost of a gallon of gas or produces the outcome for which this bill is intended. And again, I speak from the railroad perspective and am very aware of my responsibility to provide you our best technical assessment as an element of the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Gamble? Thanks again, Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to be holding this bill over till next week. We're attempting to line up one more refiner, at least one more refiner, and Ed Sniffen, the AG that handles consumer issues. And with that, we'll adjourn at 5:02.